Hi everyone. So I just want to thank the Goldstein family for sponsoring this month's cheer. It was sponsored by Ilya Shmasa, Sar Raitsa Bas Siom Bas Avraham Yaakov. And she was a Holocaust survivor who escaped the Warsaw Ghetto. She was named by the Pia Zetna Rebbe. And she was someone who was full of emunah, and just when she came to America, she rebuilt her life, you know, with her life here. So we thank the Goldstein family for sponsoring. And without further ado,
So good evening, everybody, and thank you. As I said, you are an extremely worthy candidate to be the one to run this monthly shiur because you really stay on top of it. And kol hakavod to you. This is wonderful to be here. I think we've been trying to schedule this since June or August, if I'm not mistaken. So very persistently, you have figured out a time that works well for you and that works well for me as well. And it's really a pleasure to be here. When you had originally asked me to come, you said it was a women's shiur, and that could be a range of all kinds of things. And you had said that because it's a women's shiur, it's something that you specifically wanted us to focus on, the mitzvah of hafreshas challah. A famous misnomer that people often make a mistake about is they think that women are the only ones who have an obligation to be mafresh challah. And that is the first thing that we need to talk about, and that is the mitzvah of hafreshas challah is one which is applicable both to men and women equally. Now, the Mishnah does say that in some way, thank you. Thank you for being so brave. Thank you. And there's one more here, if anyone wants. So yes, it is a mitzvah that is incumbent upon women, but it is not specifically only geared to women. It is something that anyone who bakes challah, anyone who is involved in this process, has an obligation to be mafresh challah. So let's try to get into the origins. Let's try to understand a little bit about hafreshas challah. I was asked, I'm going to follow the instructions. I was asked to talk a little bit halacha, a little bit hashkafa, correct? I'm following all the rules, and to be done at 9:30. That's what I was told. So I'm going to try to respect everyone's time and try to get as much as we can in the short amount of time that we are given together this evening. Obviously, the mitzvah of hafreshas challah, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, there's a lot there. There's a lot to talk about. Many simanim have discussions about all the intricacies of how to be mafresh, and when to be mafresh, and when not to be mafresh, and how to do it properly, and what happens if there's a mistake. We're not going to be able to get into everything this evening. I try to highlight some of the points which are probably most interesting and most relevant to all of us on an ongoing basis. The first and primary question that we always need to ask ourselves whenever we're involved in any kind of halachic discussion is the mitzvah that we're dealing with something which is a mitzvah midaraisa, or is this only a mitzvah midirabbana? So let's begin with the pasuk. Pasuk says in Parsha Shlach, which is not on here, the pasuk says we have a mitzvah, bivo'achem el ha'aretz, when you come into the land and you're going to eat, v'haya ba'achalcha milechem ha'aretz, when you eat from the bread of the land, then you have a mitzvah to be mafresh challah. That is what the Torah says. Now, the Rambam says, when we talk about the mitzvah of truma, for example, come be brave. Amazing. The mitzvah of truma. So we have a mitzvah that you're supposed to give some of your produce to the Kohen. In some way that's similar to challah, because challah is also supposed to be given to the Kohen. Now, nowadays, we don't do that, as we'll see in a few minutes. But truma and challah, in some ways, are interchangeable. When it comes to the mitzvah of truma, and you ask yourself, is the mitzvah of truma something that is obligatory min ha-Torah, bizman hazeh, or perhaps not? So let's look at the Rambam. The Rambam says here, in Perek Aleph, Hilchos Trumos, Halacha Chavav, it's the first entry on the source sheet. The Rambam argues that truma today is only a mitzvah midirabbanan. Why? The Rambam says because you need two qualifications. There are two conditions that have to be met in order for truma to be midaraisa. What are those? Number one, says the Rambam, the only time that truma is midaraisa, ein lecha truma shel Torah ela be'eretz Yisrael bilvad. Number one, truma is only an obligation in Eretz Yisrael, which I'm sure many of us have heard what happens when you have the Jaffa oranges that are brought over to Costco here. Only an issue in the 5 pounds? You have Costco here? Yes. Or similar kinds of stories. So we've all encountered that. Now, why is it only a problem when you have the Jaffa oranges coming from Israel? What about the oranges from down the block? The answer is because the Rambam says that truma is only an obligation when we're talking about produce from Eretz Yisrael. And number two, the Rambam says, even if it's produce from Eretz Yisrael, the only time truma is applicable is bizman shekol Yisrael sham. Only when the entire Jewish people lives in Eretz Yisrael is there then an obligation to be mafresh truma. But say today, when we don't have the entire Jewish people, and we don't even have half of the Jewish people, now we're getting close to that tipping point, but if we don't even have half of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael today, then Truma would not be a mitzvah mida'araisa. Now that is with regard to Truma. How does that translate into the mitzvah of challah? Let's look at the Rambam together in number Beis. The Rambam in Hilchos Yisuri Bia says, challah b'zman hazeh va'afilu be'eretz Yisrael eina shel Torah. When we're talking about the mitzvah of hafrashas challah today, it is not a mitzvah mida'araisa. Even though the Torah itself instructs us to be mafresh challah, but in the conditions in which we experience today, and the way things are, the Rambam says, this would not be a mitzvah mida'araisa today. Shenemar, how do we know? Because the Torah says, bevo'achem el ha'aretz. One of the preconditions to be obligated in the mitzvah of hafrashas challah is when you come into the land. And that, the Rambam says, is only when you have bias kulchem. It's only when the entire Jewish people, or most of the Jewish people, come back to Eretz Yisrael. Today, unfortunately, that is not the situation that we are looking at. And that is why the mitzvah of Truma and the mitzvah of challah today are only midirabbanan. Now, you'll ask yourself, what difference does it make? Challah d'araisa, challah d'rabbanan. Either way, we have an obligation. Just a few weeks ago, we celebrated Hanukkah. So I should say, well, Hanukkah is only d'rabbanan anyway. So you know what? Forget it. I won't do the menorah. Purim is only d'rabbanan coming up. You know what? I won't listen to the Megillah. We don't think that way. We are pretty serious about a mitzvah mid'rabbanan as well. So why would there be any distinction between something that is a mitzvah mid'araisa and a mitzvah mid'rabbanan? The answer to that is based on the Gemara in Maseches Brachos Daf Chaf Aleph, where the Gemara says that we have an overarching principle, which is Safek d'araisa l'chumra, v'safek d'rabbanan l'kula. So say, for example, we have a mitzvah every day to recite Kriya Shema, every day in the morning and every evening as well. What if a person is safek kara, safek lo kara? I can't remember. I have a million other things on my mind. I went to pick up the carpool. I went shopping in the store. I had to take care of everything else in my house. I can't remember. Did I daven? Did I not daven? Did I say Kriya Shema? So what's the din? Well, the halacha is, since Kriya Shema is a mitzvah mida'araisa, therefore we say, out of caution, you should recite Kriya Shema again, because it's a mitzvah mida'araisa. If it would only be a mitzvah mida'rabbanan, for example, tefillah, if I'm not sure if I daven Shmona Esrei, and I can't remember whether or not I have fulfilled my obligation, since Shmona Esrei is only a mitzvah midirabbanan, we would say, safek d'rabbanan l'kula. And you don't have an obligation to go back and recite it again. So that would be a major difference. So here, has it ever happened to you? Don't raise your hand, because I don't want to embarrass you in front of anyone. But I have gotten the shayla, so I know it has happened to someone out there in the world, where you're baking, and you're putting together your challah, and you can't remember, was I mafresh challah, was I not? Now, the easy answer is check in the oven. Your hafrasha should be there. Now, you may be one of those people who doesn't burn it in the oven. I just had a shayla a couple of weeks ago. Somebody called me that they were mafresh challah and they couldn't find it. And they couldn't find where it was. Now, it wasn't in the oven. And they said they always burn in the oven. They don't just throw it out. Anyone here have the minhag to throw it out in the garbage? Right? So two different minhagim. Some people throw it out. Some people burn it. We'll get to that, hopefully. If you give me an extra 5 minutes in the end, I'll get to it. Okay, so we'll get to that. Though at this rate, I'm not sure we'll get to anything. We'll just talk. It's interesting. So I'll have to come back for part B another time. So the woman said she always burns it. And she was looking. She couldn't find it anywhere. And she realized one of her friends, it was a bunch of seminary girls who were baking together. They realized one of the girls thought it was just another separation, I guess, to make the braids, you have to separate, same size probably. And she said one of the girls put it back in. Now that's a very serious shayla. What do you do now? Now that the hafresha has been put back in and everything has been baked. So now what do we do? What? Ataras Adarim. So that's like, you know, very fascinating. I guess this has happened to more than one person before. So you do a Ataras Adarim. It's very fascinating. It's very interesting. But something that we should be careful that it doesn't happen. But the point being that when you have a suffix on the hafrasha, that is a big discussion in the Achronim, do we assume that that would go under the general category of suffix d'rabbanan l'kula? And based on the way the Rambam explains the mitzvah hafrasha schala today, it would really be a good argument to be made that if somebody is unsure whether or not they were mafresh chala, we should say that since it's only d'rabbanan today, there is no obligation to go and do it again. Say, for example, we have another Mishnah here which is fascinating, and you'll say, this never comes up. Rebbetzin, thank you for hosting. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here. So the Mishnah Maseches Challah gives a very interesting case. If you look here, I thought I put it on here. Apparently I didn't. The Mishnah says, what happens if you have a Gersh and his Geyer? You have somebody who converts. Now, why this Ger or Gioras was in the middle of making challah in the middle of this process? Strange. I don't know. But they had all kosher ingredients in the house, and they prepared the dough, and they were so excited. It's a Thursday afternoon. They're about to experience their first Shabbos as a Jew. I'm not going to eat bought challah from the store. I'm going to make my own challah. Now the question is, are they chayiv in hafrasha? So the Mishnah discusses, well, when was the dough needed? Was the dough needed before you became a ger or gioras, or was the dough needed afterward? So the Mishnah says, if the dough was needed before, there's no chayiv hafrasha, because at the time of the kneading of the dough, you were not obligated in the mitzvah. If the dough was needed after, obviously there's a chayiv hafrasha. Says the Mishnah, what happens if there's a suffik? What happens if you're not sure? Can't remember. So many things happen. I'm so overwhelmed by the fact that I just converted. I'm so excited about the fact that I'm now a Jew. I can't remember. Did I knead the dough? Did I do all this before? Did I do it afterward? I can't recreate the story. Says the Mishnah, in such a case, chayev es b'chala. You're chayev in chala. Why? Why should you be chayev in chala? Didn't we just say, suffik d'rabban l'kula? So the Mishnah says, yes, you're chayev in chala, but because it's only a suffik, therefore we say, the Shach writes, you should not make a bracha on that hafrasha, because we're not sure. And to make a bracha means you have to be very sure that you need to do this. So what's the big deal? Take off a little piece of challah and be mafresh anyway. But to allow somebody to make a bracha, you have to be very certain that you have an obligation to observe and perform this mitzvah. And that is why the psak is that in such a situation, one would not recite a bracha, because we assume safed yarabana lakula would be enough to say, don't recite a bracha, because we have enough concerns about whether or not you have a chiyuv in hafrasha. The point being, if one ever has a suffix, whether or not they were mafresh challah, this is part of the overall discussion of whether or not challah today is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. Either way, it's very clear in the Rambam that challah in our generation, outside of Eretz Yisrael, certainly is only a mitzvah mid'rabbanan. So you ask yourself, every time there's a mitzvah mid'rabbanan, there has to be some motivation, there has to be some impetus that made the chachamim come up with this idea. Why would they arbitrarily decide that there should be an obligation to be mafresh challah? Why? If it's not applicable today, if we don't have most of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael and we don't live there, then why would it be something that they have now carried over to all of us living in Chutz La'aretz? Don't we have enough mitzvahs to worry about? Don't we have enough things going on in our kitchens to take care of? Why did we need the extra mitzvah of hafreshas challah? What was the motivation? So this is a question that is asked. And the Shulchan Aruch writes, the reason why we have a mitzvah of hafreshas challah midrabbanan in our generation is because, kidei shelo tishtakach Torah challah meYisrael, in order that the mitzvah of challah should not be forgotten. How many years have we been in Galus? How long have we been here? A long time. What's going to happen if for all these centuries, for all these generations, when Jews find themselves outside of Eretz Yisrael, and they have not observed, they have not fulfilled the mitzvah of challah in thousands of years, what's going to happen? No one's going to remember. No one's even going to think about it. No one's going to be aware of the fact that there's even a concept of hafreshas challah. And kidei shelo tishtakach Torah challah meYisrael, in order that we shouldn't forget about this very sacred and beloved mitzvah of hafreshas challah, that is why Chazal decided that this is important, that we make a takana midirabanan, we make a chiyuv dirabanan, that everybody must be mafresh challah in Eretz Yisrael, out of Eretz Yisrael, even at a time when it's clearly not the obligation that the Torah says we have. Now that's a very interesting concept, because we find this in other places as well. Kidei shelo tishtakach Torah something meYisrael. For example, the Gemara gives a case, Shemitah, right? So we just experienced a Shemitah last year. Shemitah in our generation is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan? Shemitah today is only mid'rabbanan. The Rambam says we don't have the qualifications today of what Shemitah once was, same thing that we just described. So why do we have such a to-do about Shemitah today? And you're going to eat by this restaurant and by that person's house. You're not going to eat there. You're going to do this hashgacha, not that hashgacha, etter mechira, and all the different things. Why? All of that is midrabbanan. Why? And the Gemara says, we have the concept of shvias meshametes. When you come to a Shemitah year, it's not only about the produce, it's also about forgiving loans. Every 7 years, we're supposed to forgive the loans. So that shouldn't be applicable today either. But the Gemara says, we do observe that today. Kidei shelo tishtakach Torah Shemitah meYisrael. We don't want everyone to forget about the holy mitzvah of Shemitah. And therefore the Gemara says, we have a takana de rabbanan that reminds us of this mitzvah, even at a time when the conditions may not be met. The Gemara gives a very interesting case. Masach HaShabbos, Samach Tes. The Gemara says we have a situation where somebody is mahalach baderech, which is uncommon that it would happen today. Somebody is traveling in the desert somewhere, and they have no cell phone, and they have no service, and they don't know what day it is, totally disoriented, and I don't know where I'm up to. So what am I supposed to do? Would you tell me that every day I'm not allowed to walk anywhere because maybe it's Shabbos, and maybe I'm walking out of the Tchum, and maybe I'm carrying Muksa, and maybe whatever. What are you going to tell me? That I'm going to be stuck in the desert forever. I'll never get out of here. So the Gemara says, no, you continue to walk, keep walking to try to get yourself out. You have to try to find civilization again. However, the Gemara says, Mona Shisha Yamim Umishamar Yom Echad. You count 6 days from today, even though it might be Tuesday. You count 6 days from today, and the seventh day you're going to observe a Shabbos. What do you mean? What significance does that have? Count 6 days from today, and then the seventh day is going to be Shabbos for you? That's going to be a Wednesday afternoon. That's going to be a Thursday. Maybe it's Shabbos, but you have a 1 in 7 chance that it's Shabbos, and a 6 out of 7 that it's not Shabbos. So arbitrarily, we decide you should count 6 days and then keep Shabbos. Why? The Gemara is, Kadei Shalot Ishtakach Torah Shabbos Meisro. What's going to be? You're going to forget about Shabbos. If you're going to go weeks and weeks or months and months in this civilization, and you're not going to know when it's Shabbos, you're going to forget about Shabbos. And the Gemara says, therefore, Kadei Shalot Ishtakach, we don't want Shabbos to be forgotten. Therefore, we have this motivation for a person to take upon themselves Shabbos, even when chances are it actually is not Shabbos at all. Now, this is a very interesting concept because the truth is, the Gemara says, what happens if you live in a community where 1 year it comes Sukkot and we don't have an Esrog? So what would you do? What should you do? Right? We hear these stories about these European towns where there was 1 Esrog for their whole town. You don't hear the stories about the town where there was no Esrog for their whole town, but that happened. So what do? The Gemara says, I would venture to say, we don't want to forget about the mitzvah of Esrog, so maybe we should just take a lemon. Maybe we should take a pomegranate, something else. Just hold something so that everybody will remember when we do have the opportunity down the line to take an Esrog, we should remember that there is such a concept. There the Gemara says that would be inappropriate. So it's hard to strike the balance. Where do you say, yes, Kadei Shalot Tishtakach, in order that it shouldn't be forgotten, let's make sure that we do something to remind everybody what the mitzvah is, when it's applicable, how we do it. And when we say, you know, maybe that's not appropriate. Maybe if we're not able to do the mitzvah where they were the way we're supposed to, then forget it. We're not going to do it at all. This is a fine line that we have to balance when we're trying to talk about a mitzvah that may not be applicable in a particular situation. We have many different variations of breads nowadays. People I've found in our community have become much more creative and experimental. Anybody find that here today? Right, so we have all kinds of people making sourdough. They never did it before. And all of a sudden, through COVID, everybody had so much time. I felt through COVID I had no time. But somehow there were a lot of people who had a lot of time. And they came up with all kinds of different recipes and different things. And it became a sensational item. So which kinds of ingredients would be something that would obligate me in Hafreshas Challah? I actually did a quick search today to see what are the ingredients that can be used as a base to make bread. Fair question. Some of them I didn't even recognize what they were. But the ones I saw that are most popular are wheat, barley, oats, rice, corn, millet, spelt, quinoa, and rye. Anyone ever see quinoa bread? Fascinating. But they say it's an in thing today. So the question is, if I would have bread made out of any of those items, any of those materials, would those ingredients all have a fee of Hafreshas Challah? Or would you say, no, maybe it's limited to a smaller group and not expand it to anything that looks like bread? That is a very fundamental question, especially in our generation where people are trying to experiment with all kinds of different items, and they're using all kinds of ingredients to create the challah recipe. So the question that we need to begin with is as follows. In general, when we have wheat, for example, wheat grows from the ground. Really, we should make a Bori Pri HaAdama on wheat and on all that comes from wheat. That should be the bracha. And the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos, you're correct, that should have been the bracha. However, the Gemara says that since wheat is something that is zun, since it's so prominent, it's such a staple of human life, therefore we assume that we're going to have a specialized bracha that is made for any product that comes from wheat. And that is, as we know, hamotzi lechem in haaretz. It should have been ha'adama, but it's not. We make a bracha of hamotzi. That, the Gemara says, is only limited to chamesh es minei dagah. That special bracha of Hamotzi is only unique to the Chameshas Minei Dagam, which are wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. Those are the only things that require Hadam. So, for example, if I make a quinoa bread, I will not make a Hamotzi on that, because that is not from the Chameshas Minei Dagam. This is something that is unique only to the Chameshas Minei Dagam. It is not only unique in the Bracha Rishona, as we know, this is also unique in the Bracha Achrona. Right, we know that this is something special that we say a Berachas HaMazon only on something which has a Toar Lechem, something which is referred to as bread. And the only way that we refer to bread is something that is made of these five ingredients. Outside of that, there would be no Chiyuv to make Hamotzi, there would be no Chiyuv to make a Berachas HaMazon at the end. Which is why there's a big question, when you have Pas Orez, when you have rice bread, what is the Bracha on that? Big discussion in the Rishonim. And even b'di'evid, if you make a hamotzi on rice bread, the Mishnah Berurah says, lo yatze yedei chogoso, you've made the wrong bracha, and it doesn't work, because that is not part of this list. So this is a very, very major discussion about how we're supposed to look at all the different minim, and especially today, when we talk about people who try to make recipes from other kinds of ingredients, what would the implication be as with regard to hafreshas challah? Is Hafreshas Challah something that is similar to the bracha of Hamotzi or the Birchas HaMazon requirement? Or do we say no, maybe there are different qualifications altogether when we come to the mitzvah of Hafreshas Challah? So we look at a Mishnah at Maseches Menachos, Daf Ayin Amud Aleph. This is number Dalet, the fourth entry here, where the Mishnah says very clearly, Hachitin, Vasaorin, Vahakusmin, Vahashibola Shuel, Vahashifon, that's wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. Hare'elu Chayavin Mechalah. The Mishnah is very clear that those are the only five ingredients that will require a Hafreshas Challah. So if I try one of these other experimental ingredients, as beautiful as it looks, and as much as it tastes like challah, and as much as it looks like it, you will not have an obligation to do a Hafreshah. And the Gemara clearly says, do you mean to tell me only these five? What if I make Orez V'dochen, which means what if I make rice bread from rice flour? Would I have an obligation? The Gemara says no, because that is not the definition of challah as far as the halacha is concerned. It's not lechem. In the same way you wouldn't make a hamotzi on it, and you wouldn't make berachas hamaz on it, so too, you would not have an obligation to be mafresh challah for that as well. So now that we've discussed which kinds of grains and which ingredients would require a hafreshas challah, we now need to discuss what kinds of doughs would be a hafreshas challah requirement as well. First of all, not always does everybody use for their batter, not always does everybody use for the mixture a water base, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. You can make a dough with all other ingredients without using water at all. Now, very often you're going to use water just to make the consistency what you want it to be. But it is yitachein. It is possible for a person to make a mixture, to make a batter, to make a dough that has no water included in it at all. And that is a discussion. Would that have an obligation of a hafresha as well, or do you say no? If there's no water, then you're missing everything. So let's look at the Mishnah Maseches Challah here, this number Hey, where the Mishnah tells us very explicitly what happens if you knead the dough with fruit juices. Anyone ever done that? You ever seen, sometimes before Pesach, right, they sell other kinds of matzahs. So anyone ever seen grape juice matzah, which you cannot use for the Seder? But they have matzah that is made from a mixture of fruit juices. It's grape juice that is used in the place of water. The reason for that is a halachic reason, because when we have Erev Pesach Shecholias B'Shabbos, and nobody wants to have chametz in their house, but we also don't want to have matzah, because we can't eat matzah that we're going to eat on Leila Seder, on Matzah Shabbos. So when we have this issue, some have come up with this idea of, oh, using grape juice matzahs, which would not be acceptable for Leila Seder, because it's not lechemoni, but on the other hand, it is still considered to be matzah. This is a discussion in the Mishnah. The Mishnah here writes, Isa shanilosha ben meperos. If I have a dough, a mixture, that instead of putting water in, I have put fruit juices in, chayav es bechala. The Mishnah says it has an obligation for a hafreshas challah. That would not make a difference. It's not that only water is something that is mechayav hafresha. It is even a grape juice or even an egg challah is something that would have an obligation to have a hafresha as well. This is what the Rambam clearly quotes from the Mishnah. This is the way it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch as well. However, the Tur points out, the Tur was the son of the Rush. The Rush was one of the Gedolei HaRishonim. Tur points out that although the Rambam does say, like the Mishnah says here, and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch are consistent with that Mishnah, although it says that when you have a batter that was mixed with mei peiros, with other items other than water, it would have an obligation to be mafresh challah, he does quote in the name of his father, in the name of his father who is the Rush, that hayim istapik bedavar. He was not 100% sure that that really has an obligation to do a hafresh on it. And because of that, the Shach recommends, the Shach is one of the most important commentaries on Shulchan Aruch Yerodeya, the Shach recommends that whenever you have a mixture that has no water in it at all, but only some other liquid that is used to knead the dough, when you have that kind of situation, the Shach recommends that it's best to be mafrish without a bracha. Now, I don't know how common that is. I don't know how often the women in this group may do that or not do that, but that is something to be aware of. That the Shach says anytime you have a non-water-based challah that you're making, the hafrasha should be done, because the Mishnah and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch seem to say that. However, because there are some Rishonim that disagree, therefore the Shach recommends that you should do the hafrasha without reciting a bracha. So, we have a dough that's made from chameshes mini dove. We have the dough that is mixed with water or fruit juices. Make a bracha, don't make a bracha. Now the question then becomes, and this is a little bit of a complicated question, what kind of batters actually require a hafrasha? You ever think about it? How come when I make a cookie batter, I'm not mafrish? So you'll say, well, that's not challah. Correct? But what's the difference?
It also doesn't even have any juice, like juice or water. There's no juice or water.
So you'll say there's no juice or water. Let's say I'm making a babka. Right?
You don't have to take challah for that.
I'm asking, right? So, what would you say?
It depends how much flour you use.
Correct. So, first of all, it depends how much flour you use. That's, in any consideration that we're going to make, the question is, when do you ever pass the threshold of when you need to be mafresh challah? That is a big shaila. It's not clear. It's interesting because when you read the Mishnayos and you go through the Gemara, there's not an exact recommendation of how much you need, and that's where there's a little bit of a guess as to what that is today. How does it translate into our measurements? The general assumption, I mean, the Rebbetzin can help me out if I'm making a mistake. The way in our house that it was always said over, and I assume it's from the same Mesorah, it was said in the name of Rav Henkin, who was the Gadol HaDor in America before Rav Moshe Feinstein came along. So Rav Henkin set the following parameters. Less than 3 pounds of flour, you don't do a hafrasha. In between 3 and 5, he said he'd do a hafrasha without a bracha. And more than 5 pounds of flour, he said, you're going to be mafresh with a bracha. Is that standard? Somewhere? Something like that? Rebbetzin, what's standard in your home? Somewhere around that. So the reason why it's a little bit hard to know exactly how much it's supposed to be is because, obviously, the Mishnah doesn't give us exact measurements that we are familiar with today. And that is why it was sort of a guesstimation that Rav Henkin made. And that's why between 3 and 5 is not exactly clear. That's why he said, be mafresh without a bracha. More than 5 pounds certainly requires a bracha. So, of course, if you're going to make that much cake and that much cookies, that's the only discussion that we're talking about. Because less than that, you would never have a chiyuv hafrasha. So I assume it's probably unusual that you're going to be making 5 pounds of flour in a cookie recipe or in a cake recipe, unless you're making a shemah brachas or you're making a simcha. But let's say you are. Let's say you make a big recipe and you have 5 pounds of flour. So why is it that when I have one kind of batter that seems like very similar ingredients to the bread, to the challah that I'm about to make, so when I bake challah, I do a hafrasha. Suddenly when I'm baking other things, I don't do a hafrasha. What's the difference? And how do you draw the line? How do you figure it out? This is what's referred to in the Mishnah and in the Gemara as a blila ava versus a blila raka. When you knead the dough, that's a blila ava. That's very thick consistency. When I have something that pours, I was trying to think today what the right word is. I think this is the wrong word, but you'll come up with a better word. Viscous, I think, is not, is it the right word?
Viscosity.
The viscosity, but I don't know, is that the right word for this?
Yeah. How quickly it pours? Like,
yeah. Right, so I think that's how, maybe we're both wrong or maybe we're right, I don't know. So I think the viscosity of the batter is the way to determine whether or not it's considered a blila ava or a blila raka. How are you going to exactly define those terms? Hard to know. So actually, the Pisgei Tshuva in Shulchan Aruch, on the bottom of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, he quotes some achronim that wonder when you make what does he call them? Lakshin. I don't know how you make lakshin, but apparently it's made from... How? How do you make it?
Pasta.
What?
Like pasta.
It can't just be pasta. It must be some recipe that makes it into that. No? It doesn't come as pasta. Like, back in the days of the Pesach Teshuvah, they didn't go to the store and buy lakshin. They made it.
They made it.
Right? So what's it made of?
It's dough.
It's dough.
Yeah.
So he says they had a big discussion about lakshin. Who said that lakshin... You don't have to be mafresh challah. Now, who would have thought? What do you mean I'm making lakshin kugel? Who would have thought that I have to be mafresh challah? That was a big discussion. Or he says, I think he talks about knedlach, or things like that, that also are made out of flour, and you have a mixture of dough and water, or some other substance, or some other liquid. What's to say that all of a sudden you have a very similar set of ingredients that you have to the challah that you're making, and suddenly you have no obligation to be mafresh challah, whereas here you do have an obligation. So how do we draw the line? How do we figure that out? This happens to be an extremely complicated machlokas harishonim, which we're not going to get into because it's very complicated. Let's just get the bottom line. Bottom line is in Shulchan Aruch here in Yerudea, in number above. Simon Shinchav Tes, Seif Gimel, where the Shulchan Aruch says as follows. Isa Shevali Lasa Ava. If you have... Do they have in this neighborhood Zeppelis? Or that's just a... That's just
pizza
by us. They have
man.
What?
The pizza pie.
Are you also from?
I'm from here. Yeah.
So you appreciate the Zeppelis. You should petition your pizza stores to have such a thing. This is like the crown of the 5 pounds. This is very important. So that's actually a great question. You can describe what it is for all those who don't know. But
it's fried pizza dough that you coat in powdered sugar.
And lots of powdered sugar.
Yeah.
So, but they're like little balls, right? So. Everyone wonders, like, what bracha are those things? What are they? So how are they made? Are they baked?
I guess it
are they
if
fried?
You wash on pizza or if you don't wash on pizza.
Let's say you wash on pizza.
And it's also a question of how many Zeppelis you're eating.
How many Zeppelis you're eating. Yeah, that's true. You probably shouldn't eat enough that you need to wash. That's probably not good for any part of your body. What?
Wouldn't it be the same thing as like garlic knots? Like, that are also making.
So that's a question. So what do you do with all these things? So garlic nuts, I think, are bread. You look at them, they're bread, right? But here, the Zeppelis, my understanding is I think they deep fry them, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do with something that is not baked in the oven, but is rather deep fried? Or donuts, right? Donuts are deep fried. Anyone here ever do anything deep fried? Baking deep fried? I mean, not baking, but like something of that consistency. If you make donuts, that's how you make them. So that's the question. It's a blila ava. It starts off with the same consistency of the dough that you're going to make bread from. That's how you make pizza. But at the same time, you're frying it. You're deep frying it. You're not baking it in the normal way that you would bake bread. So that's a major discussion in Shulchan Aruch. It's a double discussion. Number one, blila ava versus blila raka. When you have something that is that the viscosity is much greater than others, that's number one. First thing you need to factor in. Factor number two is, even if I have something that is a blila ava, that is the same consistency of dough, but in the end I'm not going to bake it in the same way that I normally would bake the dough, I'm going to put it in a deep fryer, or I'm going to put it in a pan and cook it that way, would that change the status of hafrosh challah or not? So let's see what the Shulchan Aruch writes. Let's learn it together. Isa shevli lasa ava. Over here we're on number vav together. Isa shevli lasa ava. If I have a thick batter, if I have a thick dough, v'gilgala al das levashla o letagna, and at the time that I kneaded the dough, my intent was that I was going to cook it or fry it, not to bake it in the oven. Ola sosa suvganin. What's a suvganiya? To make donuts. Oli yavsha b'chama, or I'm going to shape it and then just leave it out to bake in the sun, which is not the normal way to bake anything. Says the Ramban, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the Ramban, that in such a case, you have no obligation to be mafresh challah. The only time you have to be mafresh challah is when your intent was, number one, he's talking about a blila ava, something that is a thick consistency, that has no viscosity at all. In that case, I would say, says the Ramban, you have no obligation to be mafresh challah. Second case, gilgal alasos mimeno lechem. Let's say when I actually kneaded the dough, I had intent to make bread out of it, and to bake it in the oven, the normal way we bake bread. V'nimlach levashla o letagna o lasosos v'ganin. And then later I change my mind. And I decide, hey, I can use this dough to make donuts. But at the time that I needed the dough, my intent was that I was going to bake it as bread. In that case, he says, you're chayiv, shekvarnas chayiv al mishas gilgul, because at the time that I needed the dough, I already obligated myself to do a hafrasha. Now, I waited along long enough that I changed my mind, but I should have done the hafrasha immediately. That's the second case. Third case that he quotes here is Gilgala al das sufganen v'nimlach lasos alechem chayebes. If I decide in the end that I want to make bread, originally when I needed the dough, I wanted to make donuts. Now I decide, I change my mind that I want to make bread. So what's the halacha there? In that case, he says, if in the end of the day you're going to bake bread, then you have an obligation to be mafresh challah then. So, with regard to thicker dough, that's all the Shulchan Aruch is talking about over here. Let's say a zeppeli, which is thick dough, right? But it's cooked. So let's use that as an example. What would the Shulchan Aruch say? If you have thick dough, but at the time that I made it, my intent was that I was going to cook it instead of to bake it, in that situation, the Shulchan Aruch says, I would have no obligation to be mafresh challah. Now, if I made that all at the same time, and some of it I use for pizza, and then some of it, the leftover little pieces, I throw into a deep fryer, then that already had an obligation of challah because I wanted to use it for pizza to bake in the oven. This is a major, major shaila. When we have those kinds of batters, when I have those kinds of consistencies that are going to be questionable, where they stand on the line of viscosity. If it's something that pours, then all the achronim say you would have no obligation to be mafresh challah. That's not similar at all to a batter, which is bread material. But when I have things that are somewhere in the middle, that's where it's a big question in the Shulchan Aruch. Now, what's interesting is, when hafreshas challah was a mitzvah min HaTorah, as we started, the pasuk in Parsha Shlach does say that we have a mitzvah to be mafresh challah. That's clear. There's no discussion about that. Nowadays, it's only midrabbanan, but when it was midaraisa, and we had kohanim who were tahorim, so the mitzvah was to actually be mafresh l'challah and give it to the kohen. The kohen would then eat it and recite two brachos on it, which is something we're familiar with from Leil HaSeder. Right? When we eat the matzah, we say, Hamotzi lechem min haaretz, and alachi das matzah. We make a birchas ha-mitzvah at the same time, two brachos on one item. So in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, when we had Kohanim Tehorim, they would make a bracha number one, Hamotzi lechem min haaretz on the challah, which is normal. And then the second bracha they would make is Asher Kedushana B'Kedushaso Shel Aaron V'Tzivanu Lechol HaTruma. They would make a bracha that they have a mitzvah now to eat the truma. Now this is something that's so foreign to us. Can you imagine? You have different loaves. Imagine if you're a family of Kohanim and you have different loaves in your house, and this is challah, and this is truma, and this is this, and this is that, and you have to be careful what you touch at which time in the month. It's like complicated. It's not so easy, right? But this is what it used to be. And they would recite two brachos on the hafrasha when it was given to them. Now, as we know, Bizman HaZeh, when we do not have Kohanim Tehorim, when all of us are Temeim as well, obviously we do not have an obligation to give it to the Kohen, and we do not have an obligation for the Kohen to eat it, B'Tahara, either. The Kohen would not be allowed to do that at all. And this is something that the Gemara learns in Maseches Makos, Mikan. We have a pasuk that teaches us that a Kohen Tamei is not allowed to eat Truma, and that goes for Challah as well. So if we gave it to the Kohen, and the Kohen wanted to eat it, he would be chayiv misa bidei shamayim. So that would not be a good idea. So we don't give it to the Kohen today, and we don't bake the challah, which leads us to the minhag today, which is that we burn it. Where does that come from? Why do we burn it? So the Gemara actually says in Maseches Shabbos that we have a mitzvah. Whenever you have truma that becomes tameh, and that goes for challah as well, you burn it. Now the assumption today is that we have everything in our home is tameh, because all of us are tameh and mesim, and all of us are tamei with other kinds of tumah as well, and therefore we assume that this should be burnt. Now, Rashi and Tosas have a discussion. What is the reason why you're supposed to burn it? Is it just a practical consideration? Shelo yava takala ayado. Imagine if I'm going to have this lying around my house. At some point, one of the kids is going to put it into the oven when they're hungry, and they're going to eat it. Is it just a practical consideration? You should burn it in order to get it out of the way. You don't want anyone to be chai misa v'dei shamayim, not a good idea. So let's make sure to burn it to make sure nobody will make a mistake. Or is there an actual mitzvah, ba'esh tisrofu? Is there an actual mitzvah that you have to burn it? The same way the Gemara says you have to burn truma that becomes tamei, maybe you have an obligation to burn challah that becomes tamei as well. That is a matter of dispute between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. We had actually someone in our neighborhood a couple of years ago. They had the grandmother living in their house. And one day she woke up in the morning and was hallucinating and saying, you know, things that they'd never heard her talk about, and they didn't know what to do. And she was laughing hysterically. They couldn't figure it out. They called Hatzela, and Hatzela rushed her to the hospital. They thought she was having some kind of very serious issue. And they did all kinds of tests, and it turns out she was drugged up, and they couldn't figure out why. And what ended up happening was this family actually hosted a Shabbaton in the neighborhood, and there were some people who came from out of town, and they brought marijuana brownies, left it in the fridge, and forgot to take it out when they left. This grandmother woke up in the middle of the night, wanted something to eat, went to the fridge, saw some brownies. Why should she think otherwise? Took one out and ate it, and she couldn't handle it at all. So this is exactly why Rashi says that maybe this is just a practical consideration. You should be careful to get dangerous things out of the way, because maybe your grandmother's going to be walking around the kitchen and she's going to be hungry in the middle of the night, and she may just go take something that she shouldn't eat, and you never know what the consequence of that is going to be. So that is why we generally assume that challah should be disposed of. Challah should be gotten rid of, because this is something that is dangerous to have around your house. Similar to what the Shulchan Aruch says, the Rambam writes, if you have meat in your home that has not been salted, don't leave it around, because what's going to happen? One of your kids is going to come home from school and you're going to be busy doing something else. He's going to throw the piece of meat on the grill, not knowing that the meat hasn't been salted. How are they supposed to know anything? And we've all had kids who've traipsed up the kitchen. This is not singular to any of our homes. And therefore, the Rambam says, don't leave such meat around your house for more than 3 days, because you're going to lose track of it. Someone's going to make a mistake. Something's going to happen. So this is a general concept that we find not only by Hafreshes Challah, but by other things as well. I remember a couple of years ago, I was living in the Heights. It was about over 10 years ago, I think. So there was a couple who lived in the Heights, and there was this woman had a family minhag that they would not burn the Hafresha whenever they did it throughout the year. They would save all the hafreshes in the freezer, and then Erev Pesach, they would take all of them and burn them with the chametz. Sounds like a wonderful minhag, sounds like a great minhag. It's actually a horrible minhag. Why? I'll tell you what happened. So this family went to Baltimore for Pesach, and they had every intention of bringing along all the hafreshes in the whole year, and they forgot. So they called me in a panic. I was single at the time, so I was home with my parents in the Heights, and there was the Heights emptied out. There was no young couples who were there. So maybe the Goldbergs was still there, but there was no one else there. So this guy calls me up. He says, we're in Baltimore. I don't know what to do. We have all the hafreshes in the freezer. So then he said to himself, you know, not a big deal, because I sold the chametz. So I sold my whole apartment. So this is part of the whole apartment. I said, it's true. The problem is you can only sell things that belong to you. The hafresha doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the Shevet HaKohanim. So you're not allowed to sell something that belongs to somebody else. So you actually are about to violate Bayirah and Bayimatze Midaraisa, this Pesach, because you have chametz of another Jew under your jurisdiction in your house that belongs to them, that you're watching for them, and you have not disposed of it. Major problem. I had to drive to Far Rockaway, to his parents' house, to get the key, Erev Pesach, to go into his house, into his freezer, clear it out, get all the hafreshes, and dispose of them 2 hours before Pesach. So, not a good idea. Which is why Rashi says that we have this minhag, b'zman hazeh, to burn the hafrasha. This is why we do that. Now, the Chazon Ish writes, there are many who have the minhag to just dispose of it, just throw in the garbage, what's the difference? And the answer is, the Chazon Ish says, well, the other opinion in the Rishonim, Rabbi Tam, is of the opinion that it's not just a good idea practically to burn it, it's we have an obligation, we have a chiyuv ba'esh tisrofu. The same way by Truma you're supposed to burn it, by challah, you're supposed to burn it as well. And therefore, the Chazon Ish says, why not try to satisfy both opinions in the Rishonim? Get rid of the challah, but don't just dispose of it. It's not good to have around your house. Why not burn it in order that you should be able to fulfill that requirement of the Bali Atosus, who say that burning the challah is actually what is the appropriate thing to do in our generation. So we've discussed some of the halachas that pertain to Hafreshes Challah. As we said, a lot more to talk about, but I'm following the rules. 15 minutes left. I'm going to say a little bit divrei hashkafa as you asked.
Can I just ask a question?
Of course.
Sorry. What about, they have all those like Mazonos rolls that mm-hmm. are made, it says that it's made with fruit juice. So is that something that needs to do hafrasha on? Like if they make it in a large quantity?
Yeah.
So if...
Okay. I mean, that's, look here. If you look here...
No, I'm just
Iso sheni lo shaven mei peres chayavas
bechala. If you make a fresh schala, does that mean automatically you have to make hamotzi on it or not?
No, lav dafka. For example, if I'm making babkas, right?
So then, what about 3.5 pounds tons of cookies.
A bakery is mafreshkala, sure.
And cookies?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it depends what the recipe is, but yes, they would. Yeah.
Like, if you make cookies for a simcha.
If you make cookies for a simcha, and you have, you know, we have a friend who has one of those industrial mixers, like the really big ones. And it's really amazing that you're able to make so much at one time. But I said to him, you know, you have to be aware of the fact that probably if you're going to use this thing, it means you're using a tremendous amount of flour every time. Otherwise, you would just use the regular mixer. So you have to be aware of that. But yes, the bakeries all do, sure. Yeah.
I learned that if you put it in the oven and it opens up or something, that it's a problem that it, like, trips up your oven or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Hafresha.
If the hafresha opens up?
Yes. So...
That's subject to a very big debate in general about how do we view our ovens bizman hazeh. While it's true that on a simple level we should say the hafresha is treif, and therefore it should treif up your oven. However, today when we have vented ovens, and therefore we assume, and challah doesn't really give off, bread when it bakes in the oven doesn't give off what we refer to as real steam. Right, there obviously are fumes that come out of it, but it's not something that steams up the whole oven. So usually when you have a vented oven, there are many in our generation who are of the opinion that a vented oven is not the same as the ovens in the days of Chazal, which were sealed, and that it would become totally treif. Again, it would be different if we're dealing with something that gives off a lot of steam and gets all over the place and splatters all over the oven, but that's generally not the case when we have a fresh challah. So I would say, if it's baking in the oven with something else in the oven at the same time, that's where it's a problem. But I think generally, if you're putting it into the oven and there's nothing else in there, and then you're going to use the oven after it cools off for something else, I don't think we assume that that's a problem. Correct me if I'm wrong. Right, as soon as that. I don't know. What's the meaning of Riverdale? What?
You don't bake it in the same oven that you bake in the house.
At the same time, right. Right, but so long as you're doing it afterward, right? I think the pervasive minhag generally is, you bake it in the oven, take it out. After the oven cools off, you can bake something else. But to bake it at the same time as you're baking other things would be problematic, yes.
Right, so that's why I put it in the garbage. But are you saying, is it preferable to put it in the oven rather than putting it in the garbage?
The Chazon Ish writes, it is preferable. It is preferable to do that because there are some Rishonim who say it's a mitzvah b'sreifa. Yeah, there are some who say that.
Do you have to wait for the oven to cool off and then turn it on again?
Limigdir Milsa. I don't think you have an obligation to do that. I think it's just, if you're not going to do that, then the next time around you're going to put both in at the same time because you're thinking about hot ovens. So.
If it was double wrapped in like two layers of oil or something, I'd still preferable to separate it.
Meaning if it's double wrapped and you want to bake it at the same time as your challah?
That's,
you know, I don't know. It's hard to know. You know, sometimes when you go away to a hotel, right? And it's a non-kosher program, and you know they tell you they're going to have the kosher food, and everything's double wrapped. And there, is it kosher? Of course it's kosher. Does it make me very uncomfortable that my food is cooking in the same oven at the same time as all the tray of food, even when it's double wrapped? Yeah, it makes me very uncomfortable. But different people feel differently about that, you know. So this would be the same.
If you are making two batters at the same time, mm-hmm. So in other words, it'll total over 5 pounds, but half of it is for babka and half of it is for a challah. Can you put like the two together and then like make one hafreshes challah bracha and take a little piece from both of them?
Sure, yes.
That's how, okay.
Yes, I don't even think you have to take from both of them. You take one, okay. Which works for both. One major discussion that we didn't get into is, when you have the opportunity, even if you make less than 5 pounds of flour, is there ever an opportunity to be chayv and challah subsequently? If at the time that I baked the challah, there were not 5 pounds of flour, is there any possibility that later on I could be obligated in challah? Now you'll say, how can that be? What do you mean? I baked less than 5 pounds of flour. So the Mishnah does give three different scenarios where it's possible. Number one is called meshicha, which never happens today, because that means when I have a batter of dough on the counter, and let's say this is a 3 pound batter, then I'm making something else over here that's, another 2.5 pounds and 3 pounds over there, and all of a sudden they all get connected. Neshicha means it's no sheikh, means it's connected enough that if I would pull a piece, it would bite a little bit from the other ones. So that never happens because, you're going to make three different recipes and they're going to be on three different sides of the counter, and then maybe it can happen. It actually did happen. I go to Camp Simcha in the summer, And sometimes we do have a lot of campers who each do a kneading of dough on their own, and then they all put it on one big table and everyone's playing around and whatever, and then it turns out that that really might be an ashicha, because one's batch of dough is touching the other, and then the third is touching the third, and if you put it all together, it is more than 5 pounds of flour. So that is one example that is discussed. The Shulchan Aruch talks also about the case of tziruf sal, which means when I have many breads after they are baked, if they're put together in a basket, even though at the time of the kneading there was no required amount of 5 pounds of flour, but if I put them all together afterward, let's say I bake at 5 different times during the day, and then when I have the finished product, they're all now together, whether that would be something that would obligate this whole batch in challah, which is also something that is a little bit unusual, a little bit uncommon, but more common than you would think. A big discussion in the contemporary poskim is, would my freezer be considered a sal? Right? So the case that the Gemara gives is, you know, when you have a tzir of sal, when you throw all the breads into a basket, like in a bakery, well, is my freezer considered a basket? And if so, then I'm in trouble, because I have so many challahs over the different times that I put things in the freezer, and maybe each time that I baked, it was not enough of the requisite shear to then obligate me in challah on its own, but now when you put all that together, maybe it would be a different story. So anyway, that is a big discussion, as we said, for the part two, for another time. So just a quick word about Hafrashas Challah, and I see we're really almost out of time, so maybe it should be even quicker of a word. So I was thinking today, actually, that Rashi writes that when Yitzchak Avinu experienced the loss of his mother, and then he got married, and he brought his wife into the Ohel, he saw that there were three characteristics that came back into the home. And what were those? So he saw the Anan Kasher Al Ha Ohel. He saw that there was a cloud above the Ohel. And he saw that it was Abracha Metzuyah B'Isa and Ner Dolek Me'erev Shabbos La'erev Shabbos. And that reminded him of the experience that he had of his mother, of Sarah Yimenu. That's what was missing ever since his mother passed away. And that's what was brought back into the home after his mother, after his wife now, came into his life. So, I don't think it's coincidental that the Mishnah writes that there are three things that a woman has to be mindful of. Nida, Chala, v'hadlakas haner. Those are the three mitzvahs that apply and are very special to a woman's life experience. Nida, Chala, v'hadlakas haner, I think, are a reference to these three different attributes that Yitzchak Avinu sees by his mother, and then once again by his wife. Number one, the Anan Kasher Al HaOhel is a reference to Kedusha V'Tahara in the house. And that is everything that Taharas HaMishpacha is about. And the second aspect of what he saw was a Bracha Metzuyah B'Isa, that his mother was careful with the mitzvah of Challah. And finally, Hadlakas HaNer, which is clear. She had a Ner Dolek Me'erev Shabbos La'erev Shabbos. And these are the three very special and highlighted mitzvahs that a woman has to be careful, to be mindful of, and to be aware of. When you think about the Beis HaMikdash and what were some of the most prominent features of the Beis HaMikdash, it is clear that the Beis HaMikdash had those three as well. Beis HaMikdash had a Shulchan, which was a Bracha Metzuyah B'Isa. It had bread all the time. Lechem Lefanai Tamid. It was there all the time. The Beis HaMikdash had not only a Shulchan, but also a menorah, which was a Ner Dolek, a Ner Ma'aravi, which was lit all the time. And finally, the Beis HaMikdash also had that sense of Kedusha V'Tahara that came from the Mizbeach, the pillar of smoke that the Gemara says miraculously came down and hovered over the Beis HaMikdash and the Mizbeach and the Karbanos all the time. This was something that really highlighted the essence of what the Beis HaMikdash actually was. And I think the message there is that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of all of us is to figure out how to recreate that experience of Beis HaMikdash, that experience of Kedusha V'Tahara in all of our homes. It's something that Sarah Imenu was able to create. It's something that Rivka was successful in creating. And it's something that means is not out of our reach to create either. It's an ability that we have to bring all of those characteristics into our homes, into our experiences, into our families, and into all that goes on behind the closed door of our home as well, and to remind ourselves that we all have that opportunity to be able to invest and infuse that sense of Kedusha V'Tahara into our bias, into our own Beis HaMikdash as well. As we know, the Gemara says, Ish v'isha zachu shchina shruya b'nehem. The aspiration of every Jewish home is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should feel comfortable in that house, and that the Ribono Shel Olam should feel a presence in one's home. That's really what the goal of all of our homes is all about. And whatever else goes on in there is all commentary. But everything that we're trying to build toward, all that we aspire toward, is that we should be able to build that kind of avira, that kind of influence, that kind of understanding of what our home stands for. A couple of years ago, I read something very insightful from the Talmud Rebbe in Yerushalayim. I don't know if anyone here is familiar with him. He's a great tzaddik, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and he's just, I find, a very original thinker. And the Talmud Rebbe wrote on Parsha Shlach a whole discussion about how he finds in so many different ways that the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah is an anomaly. There's something very incongruous about the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah in comparison to many other mitzvahs. Number one, he says that when we look at the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, let's look at Rashi here on the bottom, number Zion, the bottom of the page. Rashi says, Meshuna biyazum mikol biyo shebetorah. Shebekula nemar kisabo kisabo lefikach kulan lemedo zumizu. V'kiven shepar lacha akasa ba'achas mehen she'ena ela la'acha yerusha v'yeshiva. Ach kulan kein. Avol zu nemar ba bevoachem. Rashi points out that when we are introduced to the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, there's a different verb, a different phrase that is used in trying to explain what the obligation is and when the obligation was offset. Rashi says, by all the other times when we have mitzvahs atluyas ba'aretz, it says kisavo or kisavo. Suddenly, when it comes to the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, it uses a new term, which is bivoachem el ha'aretz. So what is this curious phrase of bivoachem, Rashi says? Rashi, quoting the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin, writes, it means, mishenichnesu ba ve'achlu mischayvu b'chalak. Immediately, when they came into Eretz Yisrael, the first mitzvah they had to do was Hafrashas Challah. All the other mitzvahs, mitzvahs hatluyas ba'aretz, truma and meiser and everything else, leket shikhal peyah, all these other mitzvahs that have an agricultural nature to them, were only applicable 14 years into them coming into Eretz Yisrael. Sheva shekivshu v'sheva shechilku. They waited 7 years till they conquered the land, 7 more years till they divided up, everyone got settled. 14 years later was the first time they did the mitzvah of Chumas and Maisos and everything else. But when it came to the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, immediately. Talmud Rebbe wondered, why? What's unique about Hafrashas Challah? Why should this be an obligation right away when you come to the land of Eretz Yisrael? Why shouldn't it be the same as all the other mitzvahs that have only a starting point after 14 years? Let me get settled. Let me find my bearing. Let me figure out what I'm doing here. And then we'll talk about Challah. Why is Challah the aberration from all the other mitzvahs of Tluyas Ba'aretz? That's one question he asks. He asks another question, which is interesting. You look here in number Ches, where he quotes a medrash. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Lama nismacha parshas Challah leparshas Avodah Zarah. You can look it up later in Parsha Shlach when the Torah introduces us to the mitzvah of parshas Challah. Immediately after that, the Torah talks about somebody who serves Avodah Zarah. What is the connection between the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah? What is the relationship between that and someone who serves Avodah Zarah? Obviously, they're not similar at all. But the Medrash says, Lomar lach, shekala makayim mitzvah Challah ki ilu bitel Avodah Zarah, v'chala mevatel mitzvah Challah ki ilu kiyim Avodah Zarah. Whoa. That sounds very extreme. If I'm careful about the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, it's as if I've destroyed Avodah Zarah. And if I'm reckless, if I'm careless about the mitzvah of Challah, it's as if I've served Avodah Zarah. It sounds very extreme. If I were to ask you of the 613 mitzvahs, like, which ones, if you don't do this, would it be like borderline Avodah Zarah? I think Challah would have not made it onto that list. Would have said other things. Right? The Torah says, if you destroy a Beis HaKnesses, Osasim Kein Hashem Elokeichem, that's like borderline Avodah Zarah. That shows you don't really understand what a Beis HaKnesses is. You destroy a shul? That means something wrong in your understanding of who HaKadosh Baruch Hu is and what he represents. Challah? Okay, again, it's one of the 613 mitzvahs. It's wonderful. It's great. It's important. I'm not trying to minimize, but if any of us were tasked with putting that into a category, I would venture to say most of us would not have put this into the borderline Avodah Zarah category. So what does this medrash mean? And finally, he points out, the Navi Yechezkel, when he describes the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, he writes in the very end of this pasuk in Amar Tes, Vereishis harisoseichem titnu lakoin lehaniach bracha el beisecha. If I give the challah to the Kohen, it will be a bracha to my home. Why? What is unique about challah, and why is it that I'm zocha to a bracha if I'm mafresh challah? That's what the Navi says. Why? What's so unique? So he explains as follows. He says that when you have a farmer, anyone here had the opportunity to hear this Ilana Twig speak during Shemitah? This Shemitah farmer? Not her in particular, but there were plenty of them. I found the women's presentations were so much more compelling. But I was amazed to hear from her, not only about the Mesiras Nefesh of a farmer during Shemitah, but how much work goes into a farm the other 6 years. Maybe it's just, I'm a total Am Haaretz, so I don't know anything. But it was amazing to hear what kind of hours they put in, how much work it is. And I asked her about this process and how much goes into it, one product to come out. And she was telling me about the digging and the pollination and the fertilization and the seed dispersal and the plowing and the sowing and the waiting. And then you wait. And she said you could have years. When after all these weeks and weeks and months and day after day of work, it just doesn't go. Nothing comes. And you suffer a loss. And after all the work, the farmer waits with great anticipation and great apprehension and very concerned that maybe all that work is going to go to waste and nothing's going to come from it. Which is why the pasuk says that we're all familiar with, Hazorim b'dima, b'rina yiktsoru. So it's a reference to Geula. But think on the practical, simple level. Talk to a farmer. Hazorim b'dima. It's real back-breaking labor. It's difficult. It's a tremendous investment of time. It's something that's very, very hard to do. But Barina Yiktsoru, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu finally answers your prayers, after all that you've invested, and you're just waiting, and you're waiting with great apprehension and tremendous anticipation, and you don't know what's going to be, and in the end, the product comes out the way you wanted it to be. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has answered your tefillah, Barina Yiktsoru, yes, in fact, it's extremely exciting. And yes, it's something that is overwhelming for that farmer to experience. Now what happens? Now your produce has grown. You turn your back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and you say, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Now, you make it into flour and you take over. And everything from that point on is totally predictable. Is completely expected and routine. I harvest the wheat. I make it into flour. I then package it. I put it into the recipe. I let the dough rise. I put it into the oven. I add all my ingredients. Comes out exactly the way I want it to. Although it's true, we know challah never comes out exactly the same. I got it. But in theory, it's a very predictable process. And it's very easy for a person at that point to say, there is no HaKadosh Baruch Hu involved in my life at this point. That's the mitzvah of Hefresh Challah. That's where it is. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, for a farmer to realize that I'm involved in the process is easy. They know they have to wait for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha to kick in. For me to go to the supermarket and to buy a bag of flour, to knead it in my own home, to put it into the oven, for it to come out exactly the way I want it to, it's very easy for me to deny the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because this is so routine. This is something we're all familiar with. It's so predictable. It's like the Gemara says, we're supposed to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'll call Neshima Uneshima, on every breath that we take, because it's not a given that we're going to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for every breath, because who doesn't breathe? Unless you have someone, Rahmana Litzlan, in your family who has trouble breathing, when all of a sudden you start realizing, this is a tremendous bracha. This is a really great gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me. Right? The word olam, some say, is milashon he'elam, ne'elam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hidden. Like the Navi calls him, the Navi Yeshaya refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a kel mistatir. My father likes to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does such a great job hiding, we don't even know to look for him. We don't even know to look for him. And this is why, suggests the Talmud Rebbe, we have the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah, to come and remind us at this point in the process, when it is so easy to deny the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when it's so easy to claim Kochi Ba'otzem Yadi, that I finally have success, that I have the ability to create something, it is at that moment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs us of the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. So he gives a tremendous insight where he says, you know, the story of the Meraglim, every year when we read it, it's so troubling. These were the great tzaddikim, the leaders of the generation, and so many mefarshim try to figure out what the story was, how can they make this mistake. So some suggest that perhaps what happened was they were concerned. We're living a miraculous lifestyle. They were l'shem shamayim niskavnu. We have the be'er, we have the man, we have anani hakavod, we have everything in the world. And what's going to happen? We're going to go into Eretz Yisrael, we're going to have to start working, we're going to have to start making a parnasa, I'm going to have to start doing everything on my own. How am I going to be connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You know what the answer is? The first mitzvah, bivoachem el ha'aretz. The first mitzvah you have when you come into Eretz Yisrael is, you're going to have to eat tonight. Remember, every meal you sat down to eat is going to remind you, an inborn reminder for every single meal, which consisted of bread back then. Now we're so health conscious. But back then, the staple of every meal was bread. Everybody ate that. Bivoachem el ha'aretz, you can't wait 14 years. You're coming into Eretz Yisrael, you're going to be involved in mundane activity, you're going to be involved in creating your homes, creating communities, going out to work, doing everything that a good Jew needs to do, but you need to be reminded, Bivoachem el ha'aretz. And the way to remember that is that every single meal that you sit down to eat, you're going to have that opportunity to be reminded that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is here in the materialistic world that you live in the mundane world that you experience, in the conventional experiences that you have every day, that is where you find HaKadosh Baruch Hu. La'aniach bracha al beisecha, why does the Navi say that giving the Hafrashas Challah is something that will give bracha to our lives? Suggests the Talmud Rebbe, the answer is because if a person lives all of life with this kind of perspective, realizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there and involved and infusing even the most mundane parts of my life, even the most predictable parts of my life, are governed by all that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me, that is the greatest bracha, to live that kind of life. It's not like HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, oh, if you do this, I'll give you that. No, that's not what this is. It's l'haniach bracha al beisecha. My whole house will be transformed. My whole outlook in life will be different. Everything that I look at, every experience that I have, and I understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved in it, it will change everything for me. It's the greatest gift in the world for a person to be able to build that kind of perspective in everything they do. And that, he suggests, is why we find this kind of reference in the Navi when he describes what it is that Hafrashas Challah is supposed to bring all of us to an understanding of. That really is the Nekuda. This is why it's Bivoachem el ha'aretz. This is why it's right away. This is why the Navi says it will bring such bracha to our home. And this, he says, is why the Medrash says somebody who's careful about the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah is kilu bitel avadazara, because it's an acceptance upon ourselves that there is nothing in the world that runs without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's involvement. Even the most simple, predictable act that we're involved with, we understand, we submit ourselves to the fact and the reality that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one that made this happen. He is the reason why we have this. He is the reason why any blessing comes into our lives. And therefore, he says, the Medrash says, kala mevatel Hafrashas Challah is kilu kiyem avad azara. V'chala makayim mitzvah Hafrashas Challah is kiilu bitel avad azara. So I thank you once again. It's a pleasure to learn with all of you together. And emir tzashem, lahagdil Torah lahadira, we should have many opportunities to learn together and to continue to grow. And mechayel el chayel, beautiful that you put this together once a month. And I thank you all for coming. Good night, everyone.